You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. So as I slowly begin to feel human again, after my brush with the dreaded COVID, I would like to say a big thank you to everyone that's dropped me a line or sent me their best wishes. It really has meant a lot, and I'm grateful for those who have taken the time to send me a note. I really do appreciate your kindness. Thank you. Anyway, regardless of my rather new, throaty voice, let's get on with the show. And today, I'm joined by Les Vallez, the co-founder of Opus, the organisation for paranormal understanding and support, as well as rising to the position of Assistant State Director for California whilst working for MUFON. Les continues to investigate cases and support those who feel they have experienced a variety of extraterrestrial phenomena. Les discusses his work and the support they offer through Opus to traumatise people, along with some of the cases he has dealt with through his time with Opus and MUFON. It's a thought-provoking show, to say the least. But before that, as always, before my voice packs in for good, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters for $4 a month. You can search via Patreon, or you can click on the link in the show notes. A big thank you to my latest Patreons, Lisa and Amanda. Welcome to the team, and thank you. As always, Mysteries and Monsters is also on all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com, where you'll find all your merchandise needs, as well as latest news and up-to-date episodes. A big thank you to Dean Bestall for his artwork. Mysteries and Monsters is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and we are delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Now, to join Les Vallez to discuss the experiencer phenomenon. Today, we return to the field of ufology and the abduction experiencer phenomenon in the company of Lester Vallez. A former field artillery officer in the US Army, Lester joined MUFON in 91, rising from field investigator to assistant director of Northern California. During this period, he also became a facilitator for Abduction Support Group and formed Opus, the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support. Lester, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
You are very welcome. Les, you're one of those people that seems to have found their way into ufology, from what I gather, from a personal sighting that you had as a child in Connecticut when you were about 11 years old, I believe.
Yes, indeed. It was a late October evening, and I was coming back in the house, and I noticed this object, totally silent, oval-shaped, whitish in color, slowly moving from my left to my right, and it just slowly was moving. And so I ran in the house, and of course, it scared the hell out of me, and trying to get my father to come out. And by the time I convinced him to come out, the object had disappeared. And so he said, well, it's probably just a beacon of light reflecting off a cloud. Well, that didn't sit well with me. I did not believe that's what it was. And went to the library the next day and picked up a few books on UFOs. And back in those days, this is the late 50s, George Adamski was the preeminent author of UFO books. And so I started to read his books and was really totally interested in trying to understand what the phenomena was.
Yeah. Was that something that you had to kind of keep to yourself a bit, Les, when you joined the US Army? Because obviously, I'm sure many people in that period would be very aware of the end of Project Blue Book and what was going on in regards to investigations, or was this something that kind of ran parallel with your army career, and you were able to deal with both sides of your personality, as it were?
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, as you know, how interested I was at that young age, once I got into high school and then college, that interest basically waned because I was so involved with playing sports. I played in here in the U.S. They call it soccer, but it's called football. Uh-huh. And so I was a defensive back in those days, and we had actually a very good team. So I was totally involved, and I almost flunked out of college because I was just so involved with the sports and young ladies. like I say, it kind of just, you know, waned in my thought process. And then I went into the service because in school, in college, they had the reserve officer training capability corps there. And so I joined that. And when I graduated from high school, I had a 6-year commitment, 2 years active and 4 years reserve commitment to the military. And so I went through all of that, you know, got married, you know, got a job, and then, you know, started to have children. And then in 1985, I moved from Connecticut to California. And this was job related. I picked up the newspaper, the San Jose Mercury News, one day, and Stanton Freeman was going to appear at San Jose City College to talk about UFOs and the government cover up. And that, it was like somebody threw a switch, and it was like, oh my God, I have to see this guy. I have to understand what's going on. And so I did. I went there expecting to see a handful of people, but the auditorium was packed. And Stanton gave one of his inimitable presentations. It was, you know, it's inspiring for me. When I went into the lobby to leave, MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, had a table there, and an informational table. And they have a monthly journal that they publish. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to sign up, become a member, and get the journal. Well, that's when things got interesting, because a very short time thereafter, I found myself saying, this is not enough. I have to do more. And well, I found out that they have a field investigator training course that they can put people through. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to become a field investigator and, you know, roll up my sleeves and really get out there and talk to people and see what's going on. So as it turned out, almost without exception, all the cases that I got involved with turned out to be abduction type cases where people felt that they had been taken by non-human entities. So that to me really blew my mind, as far as first, you know, I was involved with the nuts and bolts aspects of this phenomena. But now you're getting into the human, you know, type of interaction with these non-human entities. And so that put a whole different spin on how I started to go down the road with regard to this phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, because I was going to ask you, Les, looking at your resume with MUFON, it seemed to be a lot of it was concentrating on the abductee phenomenon. And I was going to sort of ask you if was that something you gravitated towards? But clearly, this was something that when you were going out and investigating cases and speaking with witnesses, the phenomenon came to you rather than the other way around, it would seem.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you can imagine a person, you know, having a path in life that you're not sure what that might be. Most people don't. And I certainly didn't. But when this thing started to come about, there was no question in my mind that the steps that I needed to take to continue on that path. And maybe I'm somewhat of a fatalist in the sense that, you know, no matter what I do, and I've thought about this. I've been doing this for over 30 years. I've said to myself a number of times, okay, this is enough. I'm done. I'm pulling out, so to speak. And boom, right away, I will get phone calls from people looking for help, looking for information, and I get pulled back into it. So I think there's some hand at work here that is continuing to push me in this direction.
Yes, it sounds like it certainly seems to be the field that has attracted your talents, it would seem, Les, in regards to your abilities and your work in regards to what you've done in the last 30 years. And would you say you've been able to kind of see the change in the way people feel more comfortable coming forwards? Because obviously, as someone that's had a long interest in ufology, Les, I'm aware of how people were viewed 40, 50 years ago when anybody was brave enough to come forwards. And obviously you referred to the infamous Adamski at the beginning there, which I think anybody with a passing knowledge of ufology is very aware of George's claims, shall we say, and some of his writings and the situation that he found himself in. And it's been very interesting to see how it seems to have really changed, especially in the last 10 years. There seems to be a more mature conversation going on about this, Les. Have you found that people have been far more comfortable recently? Because obviously these are very frightened people more often than not when they feel brave enough to finally come forward and ask for help.
Well, I think that it certainly has changed. there's no question about it. I recently gave a presentation at a senior recreational center and had almost 50 people there listen to my talk. And the questions that were asked were really good, intelligent questions, and people seriously trying to understand, you know, the phenomena. And so, yes, it has changed. And of course, it's certainly been helped recently, like 2017, the New York Times article about the Nimitz incident in 2004, where these Air Force pilots off the Nimitz carrier, interacted with this object, or a couple of objects, actually. And so, you know, when you start hearing things like that, and then our own government here, you know, coming out with the fact that they've started the UAP task force, and now it's actually changing again and with another name, which off the top of my head, I can't think of it because it's this long, typical military type of an acronym. But anyway, the bottom line is that, people are seeing this and hearing about this. And so it's now at another level. And I think the next thing that's going to happen is that people that are experiencing these interactions with these non-human intelligences are the next step in, you know, coming out and talking about the fact that, hey, this is going on. Perhaps they know who's driving these things, you know, which I think, you know, a lot of these people do know, and they have communication with them telepathically. So it's an incredible phenomena. And unfortunately, the general scientific community is reticent to really get involved with it because of the, as you said earlier, about the people looking at these people and saying, well, you know, you got to be crazy to be doing this. But less and less of that is going on now. More scientific people are stepping up and starting to look at this. And I'm sure our government, and probably yours as well, is already doing that. They're already looking at this. They're already talking to people, these experiencers or abductees, and trying to understand the phenomena, in a greater way.
Yeah. Do you think that so far, as you refer to, I've spoken to a couple of people, Les, and there seems to be a bit of a frustration in regards to this, that, as you mentioned there, they seem to be compartmentalizing this subject already, whereas we're just dealing with sightings. And for me, you can't really slice this subject up into these particular sections. I think you're going to have to look at this, and it seems as if they're trying to keep the abduction or the experience of phenomenon to one side as far as they possibly can. From looking from the outside anyway, Les, it certainly seems as if, as you mentioned there, some people really don't want to dive into this subject, because anybody looking back through the history of it will see that whenever anybody's dove into the abduction phenomenon and spoken with witnesses and investigated cases from all over the world, John Mack is a prime example of someone who was obviously on a pedestal, a Pulitzer Prize winning author, a deeply intelligent man. And yet he found himself ostracized by the scientific community and his colleagues because he thought there was a real, genuine phenomenon going on here. And it deserved respect and it deserved a real rigorous examination. And yet here we are 30 years on, and it still seems, for some people, Les, I'm not saying everybody, but it certainly seems that in officialdom, it's as if they don't want to talk about this subject unless something forces their hand.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's one step at a time. And, you know, the tact that Lou Elizondo took with his group there, and positing the fact that this may be a threat, I think was actually a smart way to get our Congress to you know, initiate this program, the UAP program. So I think that the next step, as far as looking at the abduction experiencer phenomena, that's another big step. So I think, as I say, one step at a time, and hopefully, you know, they can actually, you know, put this thing right from the beginning and look at the phenomena itself from a nuts and bolts standpoint, and then step into the abduction phenomenon. And that's going to be a more difficult step, I think, for the government to take as far as being transparent. But I know they're already working on it. I mean, people like Kit Green and Gary Nolan from Stanford University, you know, they've been working with these experiencers and even done brain analysis and looking at their caudate putamen area of their brain and the connections in those areas on these people that have psychic abilities and telepathic capabilities. And, you know, it's the old chicken and the egg. Are these people been manipulated, you know, eons ago to have that capability? Or is this an awakening that was caused by their interaction with the intelligences? These are all questions that need to be answered. But right now, I don't think we have the tools or the DNA of the aliens to understand what's going on.
Very true. When you first started out working alongside MUFON, Les, would you, I suppose it's one of those things that perhaps when you go into this subject or into this field to learn and to investigate cases, when you get that first abduction case or that first experiencer case, obviously when we look back how we kind of dealt with these subjects compared to how we support these people these days, would you say you were kind of taken aback in regards to what you were able to offer these people in the regards of supporting them and assisting them? Because for all the best intentions in the world, and as you say, you know, people can obviously be very, you know, disregard these people with a complete lack of respect, Les. And I think sometimes these people have had such traumatic experiences on a variety of levels that I think simply ostracizing them and just saying, no, you're talking absolute nonsense is not what was needed. And I think, would you say when that first case appeared from you, were you a little bit perturbed in regards to what you could do as an investigator, Les, and the fact that you probably needed to be more open-minded in regards to what you could do?
Well, I think, you know, your believability quotient can be, you know, described as something that in the beginning was narrower. But now I'm telling you, it has expanded to the degree that there's not much that people will tell me that is not possible, I believe. Mm. And you're coming. Good question, Paul. When I started to work with these people, they would ask me, did I know of other people having similar experiences? And I said, yes, I do. And so the next thing I'm doing, I'm facilitating a support group. Well, I tell you, I've learned more sitting in and moderating, facilitating a support group than any book that I've ever picked up. Just listening to these people, understanding what they're going through, and the support group has been such a positive thing for these people to understand that they're not alone, that there's other people having these types of circumstances. These people are empathetic when it comes to understanding the other person. They realize the stress and fear that's going, the PTSD that's involved with a lot of this. So a good example of learning something, and it derived from a case that I got involved with a couple that had been picnicking in a state park near Santa Cruz, California. And they were coming out of the park. This is at dusk, and they noticed this light over the ocean. And this light got bigger and bigger until literally it was over their head. And it turned out to be a triangular craft about the size of a Learjet. A small Learjet. Make a long story short, there was a total of seven of these craft that came into this area and then settled in a canyon behind them. And all of a sudden, like they went around a corner, which there was no corner, and they just disappeared. Well, they were quite upset at this whole phenomena, and they started to leave the park, and that's the last thing they remember until 3 hours later, sitting in a restaurant only about usually 10 minutes away from where they were. And so they both developed a rash afterwards, and they went to two different doctors who couldn't figure out what it was. And so finally they came to our meeting, and they had taken a photograph of this rash that they had, and they showed it around to the people in the group. And almost without exception, the group said that they had a similar rash at one time or another. And one of the people in the group said, well, I know what that is. And so we all, with our mouths hanging open, said, what is it? He says, it's a reaction to the fluid that they dip you in when they bring you on board the craft to sanitize you. So anyway, I've never read that in any book. So those are kind of things that just happen, you know, time and time again, where these nuances of the experience start to unfold. You know, that's why I, you know, finally, after all these years of working with these people, I decided to, you know, put it into a book, The Unknown Other and the Existential Proposition of Alien Contact. I felt that it's important to get the word out that these people do not have a psychopathology. You know, they're not fantasy prone. They don't have any of these things that these debunkers, you know, come up with, because we've done one study called the Omega-3 study, which is the full report of the Omega-3 study is in the book. And we go through the process of working with 71 people that felt that they had been abducted and 51 people as a control group. And the things that, you know, we found out are all outlined in the book. And so, you know, we step through the physical aspects, the psychological aspects of the phenomena. And then, you know, I try to attempt to talk about the debunkers and, you know, the things like, you know, well, it's all sleep paralysis. Well, it's not. 2/3 of all these cases have nothing to do with sleep paralysis. There's no false memory syndrome. Matter of fact, the American Psychological Association nor any other mainstream psychological diagnostic system has either ratified or proven such a diagnosis. And as I mentioned, fantasy proneness certainly was not a factor. So I go through all that. And then, you know, at the end, you know, I basically asked the scientific community to step up to the plate and really take a look at this thing and in a serious way. Of course, only time will tell if that happens. And I was so lucky, as a side note here, to have Linda Moulton Howe do the foreword to the book. Linda's a friend, and I've known her for years, and I'm so happy that she had the time to do that for me.
Would you say that, obviously, your experiences when you started with MUFON, and obviously the amount of cases that started coming forwards to you, Les, would you say that that was the catalyst in creating OPUS in regards to having a framework of support for these people? Because, as you say, facilitating a support network, I suppose these days it's a lot easier because, with the greatest respect, you can all jump on a teleconference or a Zoom call, and people can speak to anybody around the world or share their stories and their experiences with people. And I would imagine, as you referred to earlier, often I'm very surprised that some people, when they come forward and they speak with people such as yourselves, they do seem to be completely ignorant about the subject, as if they think they're the only person this is happening to, Les. And often I think that plays into this aspect that, as you mentioned there, in regards to some debunkers and skeptics will say, well, these people are really into UFOs. They all watch the X-Files. They all know about it. Whereas whenever I look at the data, a lot of these people are very grounded, they're very down to earth. They don't have an interest in this subject until it unfortunately happens to them.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head in that regard, Paul. When working with all these people, I was written up in the Monterey Coast Weekly paper about what I was doing. And there was another woman that was written up in the article as well. Her name was Carol Austin. And she contacted me after this article was written, and she says, you know, I'd like to understand what's going on with my brain waves when I'm in contact with these entities. So I said to myself, well, geez, how am I going to help this person? So she says she was working with an emergency room doctor. And so that piqued my interest because I had a doctor friend, Dr. Eugene Lipson, and he was interested in connecting with other doctors that were familiar with the topic. And so we decided to go down to her place in Carmel, California, and we walked into her house, and there was a picture on a wall, and it was her standing on the back of this large craft in the Caribbean, as it turned out. And I said, what were you doing there? And she says, well, I was working with these treasure hunters. I said, well, how were you working with the treasure hunters? And she says, well, I was in contact with the captain of the galleon that went down. So that started the afternoon off. We found out that after a near-death experience, she had become very psychic. And she proceeded to tell us stories about ourselves that there was no possible way that she could understand or know. To make a long story short, Dr. Lipson and I came away that afternoon and said, how can we possibly help people with things like this? And that's when OPUS was hatched. That was in like 92, actually. And then in 1994, we officially became a nonprofit organization recognized by the U.S. IRS, the tax people. And and we've been a nonprofit ever since. So, you know, these are how that all started, you know, is really interesting. And you would never, if you were to try to plot things out, it would be interesting to see how, you know, one thing led to another, to another, to another, that finally ended up being OPUS. And, through a long chain of events.
Would you say it was needed more than anything, Les? Because often I think when we look at these kind of situations, I think sometimes you can make the mistake of it being a one-size-fits-all situation because not everybody's going to have the same kind of experience. I'm often interested in people who don't have a sighting of a craft or lights or something like that, and then... Mm-hmm. have an abduction experience or an experience of a visitation, perhaps, or a message coming to them psychically, Les. When you started to look at this, as with anything, I think when we're new to a subject, we can often have a preconceived idea of how people are going to be in these kind of situations. Would you say it was that kind of the variety of experiences that meant that something needed to be done to allow people different channels of support?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, if you look at our mission statement, you know, we talk about all types of different things, you know, whether it's poltergeist activity, whether it's spiritual awakening, you know, and all of these things are connected. They're all connected. I mean, we have people that have, you know, abduction type experiences, but also have poltergeist activity. They see orbs, or they see, you know, praying mantis type people. I mean, the variety is incredible. And so, as you say, one size does not fit all. But yet, it's amazing that when these people get together, and Opus, you know, has two vehicles that we have for people. One is our online support group, which is totally confidential, where these people can talk to one another 24/7 about their particular situation, ask questions, get information that is very helpful. They share pictures of the marks that they have after their abductions and all of this kind of thing. And then we also we have a referral network of therapists, hypnotherapists, also mental health practitioners, that if a person is looking for something like that, then, you know, we can point them in a direction. And as it turns out, which is really interesting, is that the majority of what we are working with these days are the experiencers, the abductees, you know, but almost, I mean, it's a very high percentage that also have poltergeist activity going on, you know, in orbs that they're seeing, and then in telepathic communication, as you mentioned. But I don't know why, you know, we've kind of come to the place where we are with regard to predominantly working with abductees.
I was going to say, in regards to how people come across you, because obviously you've got the website there, but as we said, sometimes these people that have these experiences probably don't understand or know how they can get such support, as you say, because often the only person they may be able to speak to, Les, is a therapist or a medical practitioner. And it's interesting that when you look at Opus and the people that you have that work alongside you, as you refer to there, that cover all kinds of phenomena, not just the abductee situation, mm-hmm. in regards to this. Has this been a situation where, when the cases have come, you've had to go out and get somebody who works in parapsychology or spiritual awakenings? Or did you kind of think at the beginning that you were going to try and look at as many types of phenomena? Or is it simply that when these cases have come to you, you've had to create a network to support these people because you don't want them to fall through the cracks?
Yeah, you know, as I said in the beginning there, that we were set to look at, you know, multiple aspects of the paranormal. But as I said, that as it turns out, we've mainly been involved with the abduction type phenomena. You know, what has proved to be the most important thing is the support group network. I think above anything has been, you know, these people can talk to other people. They know they're not alone, and right away that puts their situation in a much, you know, different, you know, light, more positive light, that they do have somebody to talk to, because most of the time they can't talk to even family members, because, or clergy or anybody, because they feel that they're crazy and, you know, they've got a loose bolt somewhere.
When you're sort of dealing with these people in the first instance, is it a case of, often people will say, oh, well, it's a specific type of person or it's a specific type of experience. And yet, as I'm sure you'll tell me, Les, it's not just that. I know often people will suggest that people who claim to be abducted or have had an experience all seem to deal with the greys. But as you referred to earlier, there are other types of entities that these people are encountering. Is that another aspect of it? Because I'm often interested when you have a support group and these people are sharing their experiences with one another. Is it a case where there tends to be a larger amount of cases that feature a specific type of experience? Or is it a real smorgasbord of situations that are going on? And it's not just greys and it's not just mantises. It's not just abductions. There are all kinds of things going on, and everybody seems to be having a different type of experience.
It is a multifaceted phenomenon. There's no question about it. However, the greys, whether it's the short or the tall greys, seem to be the most common of all of the different types of entities that people talk about. It's almost, I was talking to someone the other day and we came up with this fact that the grays are sort of like your iPhone or your Android. There's a store out in the universe that has these little guys, and everybody, including the mantis people, the reptoids, reptilians, the Nordics, the Octurians, you name it, they all shop at this one place, get these little grays to go out and pick the humans up and bring them on board the craft. And there's been instances that really quite common for these things to be more robotic than anything else. And I've even had a person rip the arm off of one, and it was like no serious reaction other than it just left the scene, and then another one came. And so, you know, are these purely robotic, or are they biological, or a combination, which I think it is, some kind of a biological robotic entity that was created to be utilized by all these different races to, interact with us, because I think they're afraid of us in a way, you know, because I've again had people lash out at these things and cause quite a bit of damage. So I think they're utilizing these grays to keep it at arm's length, so to speak.
How fascinating. I mean, that's one of those things that often I think when we look at these situations, we can often fall into this preconceived idea of someone sees something, someone gets taken on board a craft, they have an experience, they're taken back. When you have these kind of situations where people are, I mean, I've never heard of anybody ripping the arm off someone in such a situation. I've heard of people fighting back, Les, and trying to get free, and there are numerous cases where people have had quite violent encounters. Are you surprised of the variety? Because often another facet of the debunking argument would be that these people are just regurgitating the same stories over and over again. And yet, I think when you go past the initial experience, these are deeply varied situations that people are finding themselves in, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's some, you know, obviously commonalities, you know, where they're taken out of their bedroom through a wall or something, and then taken up in a beam of light, and then put on a table and examined. But, you know, all the stuff in between is all over the place as far as the actual events.
Is it one of those aspects of this that when you're looking at the bigger picture, Les, are we trying to find commonalities between why people are taken? Is it a specific genetic thing? Is it location? Is it age? Is it blood type even? Have you been able to kind of drill down past the actual experience to see if there are other aspects of this that make people more prone to having an experience, perhaps?
Well, one of the factors seems to be following generations of people, because an abductee probably has a a parent or a grandparent that has also had an experience. And so why are they following generations? Is it because they've manipulated their genes, their DNA to some degree? You know, are they, is there an experiment of some sort? And you know, the people talk about sperm being taken or eggs out of females, missing fetuses, things of that nature. Is it because they are in trouble? These entities in trouble in some way, and they need our genetics to continue, or they're modifying themselves to a certain degree based, you know. They've come here and this is a lab and we're not at the top of the food chain. And so they're experimenting. You know, I always like to say that it's like we go out in the ocean and pull a dolphin out of the water and then we take blood out of them. We tag them, you know, and then we throw them back into their environment. And so, you know, people always talk about the fact that, well, you know, these aliens are so smart, you know, they take a couple of us and that's it. They don't need to do it anymore. But it's also, it could be an educational process with the young aliens and saying, hey, this is a human. This is what you have to watch out for. This is how we take their blood. This is how we insert implants. You know, it's a learning process of some sort. There's so many variations as far as the explanation might be. And we don't have definitive answers. We just don't. And that's the head scratcher part of all of this is that I think there's multiple things going on. I mean, the fact that, you know, you have the Bud Hopkins and the David Jacobs that feel that all these entities are negative, evil. And then you have the Dr. Greer, you know, saying that, no, they're all good. It's you know. Well, I think it's the same thing like we have here on our planet. We have good people and we got bad people. And I think we got good aliens and we got bad aliens. And so, as it turns out in the studies that have been done, including the Omega study, that the majority of people feel that it's a positive experience, although the initial stages are quite negative usually. But after a while, they come to accept what's going on. And then in the later stages, it's almost like the Stockholm syndrome, where how come they're not taking me anymore? But so when asked that, you know, if they want to stop the phenomena, 65-70% of people say, no, I want to continue to have these experiences.
I was going to ask about that aspect of it, because I think it's something that doesn't really get discussed a lot, Les, is the fact that do we find people that maybe have one, two, three experiences where they are visited? And then they stop. And as you refer to there, do these people seem to then miss what's happening and perhaps think, what have I done wrong? Why don't they want me anymore?
Oh, absolutely. It's very common. It's very common. You know, it's just like, why did they take me to begin with? And now why did they stop? So, yeah. And, you know, we don't have a definitive answer on that. You know, perhaps genetic material. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, as far as the numbers are concerned, if you've had one, you've had multiple abductions. You know, it's just you just don't remember them. And we found out in the most recent study that we just finished the first phase of it. It's called the Omega 4 study. How clever of us to come up with Omega 4. And what we did is we went out to therapists. And this time to ask them about their experience with these types of clients. And so we found out some very interesting things. And, you know, you mentioned the grays before. Well, that seems to be the number one critter that people see. But then followed by orbs. Orbs are seen, tremendous amount of orbs are being seen. And then we also have poltergeist activity that seems to follow with that. So, you know, you're looking at more than one type of a paranormal phenomena that's coming into play. Yeah, it's again, we're trying to understand the phenomena, but the bottom line on what Opus is doing is helping these people cope with this phenomena, and to understand that they don't have a psychopathology in, you know, 99% of the cases. Of course, we do come across people that definitely would need the help of a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And so, you know, that's what we would recommend. But, you know, the bottom line is most of these people are, as you mentioned before, you know, really rational people. They're policemen, they're lawyers, they're doctors. You know, it's across, you know, all types of people. And it's a worldwide phenomenon. It's not just here in the U.S. It's all over the world. And, you know, that's in the support group. We have people from South Africa. We have people from the U.K. We have people from Australia, South America, Turkey just recently. So it's a phenomena that you know, I guess what it was in 1991, 92 timeframe, the Roper Organization did a study that was commissioned by Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and Robert Bigelow paid for it. Basically, it outlined at that time that they figured 6 million people in the United States have had an abduction. Well, can you imagine what that number is now and then what it is probably worldwide? So what are the aliens doing? Why are they doing this? Still, you know, going back to the big why. Why do they continue to do it? And what's the outcome? You know, if you look at David Jacobs' book about the hybrids, or as he calls them, the hubrids, because they're getting so good at creating hybrids that they look like you and I. And so you can't tell them apart. And so is this taking over the world by hybridizing people? That's a possibility, too. You know, and again, we don't have a definitive answer for it.
Absolutely. And I think when you look at this situation and this subject in general, are you still coming across cases where people are discovering implants, Les, that kind of situation is still going on? Because often when we look at this phenomenon, they don't seem to be that prevalent these days. They seem to be quite fashionable about 20 years ago, and then they've dropped out. But I would suspect that's more to do with the people who are doing the reporting rather than the actual experiences.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I get, you know, in the support group, the online support group, there are many people that have implants. And so the big question is, you know, is the implant bothering you, number one? If it's not bothering you, you probably should just leave it alone. And then number two, if it is bothering you, then there are ways to probably get that removed. You know, you don't go to your doctor and tell them that, you know, you've been abducted and they implanted something. You know, you just tell them it bothers you, and then they can proceed to extract it. But also there's been talk about the fact that you don't want to remove an implant because this upsets the entities, and then they'll come back and place it another one in a place where you can definitely not get to it. So that's a whole nother view on this phenomena. But yeah, we have people in the group, and we get them. It's not a super common thing, but we still get them. And people ask about it. You know, do we know of people that can extract them? And we have a couple of names for people that we can pass along. But at the same time, it's much easier to go to your own doctor or a chiropractor, of all things, because they're very good about taking x-rays. And if you find it, then you can take that x-ray and take it to a surgeon and say, hey, this thing is bothering me. Can you, you know, get it out? That's very practical things that go on here, you know, with regard to the implants. And then, of course, you know, Dr. Roger Lear, who since passed away here, the Alien and the Scalpel, a book about the implants that he removed. And there's some absolutely fascinating things about these implants where, you know, there's no reaction to them from the body. They're made up of materials that are foreign and not of this earth, and they transmit signals. And so, you know, is it a tracking device? Is it a device to monitor? I heard the other day that it's a device to monitor pollution levels in a person's body. Whether it's something that can actually manipulate the person that has it, that's another thing that's been posited. But again, we have no definitive answer. I mean, there's all types of, I get very skeptical about if somebody says, this is it, this is the only way it can possibly be this. And, but, you know, maybe someday we will actually get to that point. You know, like I heard a conversation that Gary Nolan at Stanford University, a biologist, that talked about the hybrid thing. And he says, well, it's very difficult to tell if a person is a hybrid because we don't have any example of alien DNA. You know, we haven't captured one of these guys, supposedly. And I think our government probably has, along with the craft and a whole bunch of other things. But according to him, anyway, we don't have a comparison to do to say to that a person is a hybrid.
Yeah, I think when you look at this subject, as you mentioned there, Les, it's very easy, and we should always be reticent about anybody that says they've got the solution, because I think often what we can sometimes miss in all this is that we don't have the answers. For a lot of us, we don't understand what is going on, and we can collect as much data and speak to as many people as we possibly can. But I still think that there's a lot of this that doesn't make any sense, does it? And it, like, as we were saying, why are certain people taken? Why do some people get implants and some people don't? Why do some people have visitations where it's more of a, it's almost as if their soul's been taken out of them and their body stays in their bedroom or whatever, Les, and it's almost as if their mind's been taken out for a trip rather than their actual physical bodies. And I think often when you can look at this kind of subject, it's very easy to say, well, this is the reason. But I think, as you mentioned in your book, there seems to be so many facets to this phenomenon. I think it's daft to kind of just write it off as one particular explanation.
I totally agree with you, Paul. And that's a good point. You know, astral projection of the body, you know, where these people, sometimes they call it lucid dreaming as well, where these things are so real and that they literally come back with, you know, marks on their body. But is that something that's caused? I know one of the most recent cases got involved with was a woman who bought a house in South Carolina, was not only dealing with a poltergeist, but with a demon. And this demon would leave marks on her body. And, you know, she would sense that it was in the room with her. And she'd feel it. She'd feel these marks being created on her back. And then, to make a long story short, brought in a person that was familiar with it, and they said there was a ley line running through the house, and that's where these creatures were coming out of, which I've never heard before. Now, that's a new one on me. I mean, I've heard of ley lines, especially in the UK. They talk about ley lines all the time. But as I said, this phenomena has so many facets, you know, and we're just scratching the surface on you know, the awareness part of it, you know, let alone the understanding part of it.
Have you noticed anything different since we've all been hit with the pandemic, Les? Because often when stressful situations occur, be it war or economic uncertainty or a change of government, perhaps, sometimes that can lead people to be in a more stressful situation. Have you noticed anything that's changed in the last couple of years, because this has affected all of us around the world? Or is it same old, same old? People are still having similar situations. Nothing seems to be changing in regards to the way people are coming forwards with their experiences.
Yeah, I think the fact that we're lucky that we do have the internet capability where you do Skype or Zoom type meetings. And I know I've been doing so many Zoom meetings with the Opus group, individual peoples, people like yourself. So I think this has been a great outlet so that if we were just totally, totally cut off, I think people would be in a worse situation. And of course, there are people out there that are in a worse situation because they don't have the capability of the internet or knowing about groups. And so, you know, that's probably the biggest thing about me writing this book is the fact that I wanted to, make it available to people, but also to get the word out that, hey, this organization exists. This is how we can help. And, hopefully make the kind of impact in the field and more awareness of groups like us. There are other groups out there, usually very local groups that exist. And we also have access to other support groups around the country that we can help people with. And that's part of the MUFON ERT, which I'm a research consultant for. That's the experience or resource team that MUFON, has put together. And I'll tell you a story about it goes back to over 15 years ago that I spoke to the international director of MUFON, who was James Carrion at the time. At that time, MUFON was strictly a nuts and bolts type of an organization, and they weren't really focused or really paying much attention to the abduction phenomena. And so I told him, I said, you're really missing the boat here. Why don't I know you're getting calls from people looking for assistance, but you have no facility, no setup, no organization, no protocol to work with these people. So I said, send me those people. So what they did was to anybody that called in, I would get the phone call forwarded to me, and I would talk to these people and find out what they were looking for. And then, give them the name of a therapist near them that could possibly help them if that's what they were looking for, or the name of a support group, or talk about our online support group. But anyway, out of that came the AERC, which was the Abduction Experiencer Research Committee that I was a chairman of. And I brought together some really high power people to look at the phenomena. And out of that came the Omega 3 study, where I worked with two other psychologists. And then we worked with 71 experiencers and 51 people as a control group. And so finally, MUFON decided that, this is something that we should do. And so they now set up their own organization internally to do the exact same thing, utilizing basically a lot of the same paperwork that Opus established. And Kathleen Martin headed that group for a while. And now Gwen Farrell is the head of that group. And they have what they call their own set of ERT members that work with the field investigators. It's like a separate group. They're all field investigators, but then they also focus in on the abduction phenomena and then also add addendums to the field investigators' reports as far as what they found. So it's getting to be, a much more organized professional endeavor on their part to deal with the phenomena. And so we work with them. We're noted as far as the under the hypnosis, hypnotherapist section, and also in the, under the support group, the Opus organization. So it's been a nice long relationship with them. And so I wear a couple of hats as it were, and it's worked out well.
When you have a member of the public that comes forward to you, Les. I'm always interested in how you sort of evaluate the support a person needs. So is it basically an interview that you guys will have with someone to discuss what they're going through and what's happening? Because often I think, once again, there is this presumption that everybody needs regressional hypnosis. Everybody needs a discussion point to be able to unload their experience or their memories or whatever. So when you get a new case that comes across your desk, how do you sort of pull that down and decide what channels of support are best for that particular person?
Well, what we do is, you know, 99.9% of the time people contact us through our website, which is opusnetwork.org. On the website itself, there's a support button. And when you click that button, there's a menu that comes up and we ask you to fill out this form. And we give you like four choices. Would you like to seek professional help? Are you looking for a hypnotherapist? Are you looking for a support group? Once they fill that out, and they're also asked to tell you know, a bit about their story, what's going on with them, and so we know right away the minute we get that. Sometimes they say, you know, I would really like to talk to someone, and part of that form they fill out, they give us a phone number, and where they're located. We'll contact them and talk to them if that's what needed. But 9 times out of 10, they're looking to join the support group. And then the other percentage is looking for a therapist, a hypnotherapist. So it gets broken down pretty quickly. Then these people show up, and I monitor along with a couple of other people in our organization, every email that goes through the support group network. And if we see something, matter of fact, we had a person that really sounded like, you know, on the edge. And so we told them that they needed to talk to the suicide hotline, which is an 800 number here in the United States. And do you have a number like that in the UK?
Yeah, we've got several organizations that offer free support 24 hours a day. So, yeah, it's something that's, especially in this day and age when mental health is extremely important, regardless of the circumstances, there's a lot of support networks out there here in the UK as well.
Yeah, I would like to understand who they are. If maybe you could send me some information on that. That would be dynamite. I'd really appreciate it. Because, matter of fact, we got a person recently from the UK. But then the support group actually was very beneficial, and this person was okay after a bit of talking to, so to speak. Any kind of information like that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I'll be delighted. I'll send you something over later on today. That wouldn't be a problem.
Sure.
I'd be delighted to offer anybody some avenue for support in that kind of situation. And I was interested, as you refer to there, when you've got these support groups, obviously some people are more experienced than others, Les, in how they've been able to handle what's happened to them and the situations they've found them in. Do you find that these support groups, people will gravitate to support the newer members and are able to help them unload what's happened? And sometimes you can take a back seat and just let the group themselves help each other?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is an incredible community, very supportive, non-judgmental, very neutral. Since 94, I've probably had to kick out only two people from the group that basically got on their high horse and, you know, this is the way it is and you're all crazy, basically. So that's a very low number, out of a fairly large group. So the group is incredibly helpful because you have people in there, as you say, that are brand new to the group. But you have older members that have been in there a long time, have had a lot of different experiences, Some of them have written books as well on the subject. And so we have a really interesting database in that regard.
Do you still find some cases give you the chills sometimes, Les? I think often we can look at this kind of subject quite humorously sometimes and think, oh, well, you know, it's an abduction case, it's this and it's that. But I think often we forget that some people are deeply traumatized by what's happened to them. Do you sometimes find cases still have the ability to shock you in how that person's feeling or what's happened to them?
Oh, sure. And I think that if it doesn't, then I've got a problem. I think that and the group is very sensitive when it comes to things like that. They'll jump right on it and, you know, give their opinion, their advice as far as, you know, how to extricate themselves from that particular situation or feeling. We talk about exercise, you know, even that is very helpful to change a person's mindset. Doing other things other than, you know, constantly thinking about the interaction that has occurred that has caused you to feel the way you are feeling. It's we get stories all the time that are, you know, matter of fact, in the book there's over 30 stories from the people in the support group that have given their story of their experiences. And so that's another thing that's very helpful as far as the book is concerned, for people to take a look and see, you know, hey, this is something that perhaps happened to you. So these people are, you know, able to sit down and write about their experiences. And that's one thing we always tell these people to do is to journal what's going on with them, to write these things down. It's very helpful to relieve stress and just doing that. And there's just so many different things that people, you know, are able to come forward with to help people, you know, and that's something that you know, as I'm speaking here now, comes to mind that you know, should chronicle these things as well. And, you know, all the list of things that people have utilized. And people sometimes come to us and say, hey, I want to stop this thing. And oftentimes I tell them about a book that was written by Ann Druffel, How to Defend Yourself Against Alien Abduction, where there's 9 different ways to stop abductions that people have utilized. Some of these things have worked based on, you know, those 9 people that tell their story that they've been able to stop the phenomena.
Fantastic. In regards to moving forwards then for Opus, what's next, Les? Is it a case of reaching out and allowing people a sounding board for support and knowing that they have this organization available if and when they need it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And this is part of, you know, being on your show is to get the word out, you know, to have your listeners hear about our organization and hopefully tell other people that are having experiences that there is a place to go. We're doing more with our website. Matter of fact, I do an interview series. I've interviewed Linda Moulton Howe and a number of other people. I've interviewed a psychic. I've interviewed a person that was involved with demons, you know, and so we're trying to broaden, you know, these types of things that you can find on our website. We also have it on YouTube, these interviews. And, you know, we're trying to come up with other ways to get the word out. You know, we have a Facebook group and page. We're not on Instagram yet, but I think that's probably going to come up as something that we might want to do. We're on Twitter, or I'm on Twitter anyway, although I don't check it very often. but I think that's something that I'm somewhat of a Luddite, as they say, when it comes to this computer and this new age stuff. I'm not a spring chicken anymore. So, the younger people, thank God I have a webmaster that is in the know and knows how to manipulate everything. And so I depend on him quite a bit. And as I say, a nonprofit organization, so we depend on the donations, and we have, you know, a donation button on the website for those people that are want to help us in some way. It's always very much appreciated. So it's something that we're evolving. We continue to evolve. I mean, it's been a long time that we've been doing this thing, and we try to come up with different things and try to put ourselves out there so people know that we exist and that we're here to help. And that's the bottom line. We're here to help in any way we can.
Yeah, I've watched a couple of your interviews, and they were fascinating. The one with Terry Lovelace and Stephen Bassett.
Oh, yeah.
They were fascinating conversations, Les. So I recommend anybody wants to learn more about them to go to the website and watch a few of those, because there are some deeply interesting conversations on there. And it's certainly a subject that once you peel back the layer of it, you can be taken somewhere you didn't expect to go, I often find, with this kind of conversation. And it's very interesting to see people who are as open and as honest, and they explain their situations about what's happened to them, and it helps people come forward and realize, as you said at the beginning, that they're not alone, and there are networks out there that can help these people deal more often than not with what's happened to them.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the frustrating thing, I think, for me, is that, you know, here we are, we're here to help, and yet there's so many people out there that don't know where to turn, you know, still. And but we're finding that, you know, especially doing shows like yours, you know, we'll get a bump in the amount of people showing up looking for help. You know, almost every time I do a show, that's what happens. And so that's why I'm, you know, really thankful to you to give me the opportunity to chat with you and, you know, tell our story.
No, fantastic. So, Les, where can everybody get a hold of a copy of your fascinating book, and also the organization if they need any support or help at all?
Okay. Of course, we're on Amazon. Like, who isn't on Amazon these days? So it's The Unknown Other and the Existential Proposition of Alien Contact, with the foreword by Linda Moulton Howe. So yeah, just check it out on Amazon. And also, what you can do is go to our website, which is opusnetwork.org. That's one word, opus, opusnetwork.org. And the homepage has a picture of the book, and you click on that, and it'll take you right to Amazon, and you can buy the book there. And if you're a Kindle Prime member, the book is free. And if you, the Kindle book, I think, is $9.99, and the paperback edition is $20. And however that translates to pounds, all the proceeds of the book go directly to Opus, our nonprofit organization. I'm not taking anything out of it. This is a way for me to keep the organization going, because we do have expenses. You know, being on the internet, you have the website costs and webmaster costs and all kinds of things like that. So it's important that we keep the fires burning as long as we can.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes for this week's episode, so anybody can track down a copy of the book and also go to the website if they have a story or an experience they wish to share, or they need any support. Les, thank you so much for your conversation. It's been fascinating and thought-provoking, and I'm delighted to finally get a chance to speak with you. As I said at the beginning, you're someone I've been aware of for a very long time, and I thank you for your time and considerable conversation this evening.
Well, thank you, Paul. I truly appreciate the opportunity. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.